city. Flickering dirty neon over alleys mean and dirty streets, while my neighborhood is torn down around.
Well, hi, everybody. This is Mike Rupert, Tracker of Truth, with some horrible feedback in my headphones, and I can't hear anything in the background, but I'm being told that we're on the air. We had some challenges getting through tonight. It's Michael C. Rupert, Tracker of Truth, from a nightclub at the end of the world, kind of flying in the fog and the rain here, not getting much feedback. Guy McPherson is with us tonight. I don't know if I'll be able to hear the songs or even hear Guy, but I hope he's there. But I hear nothing back, so we're going to try to wing this and get through with it. I had trouble calling into the station tonight. I called, and it rang and rang and rang, and nobody answered. And apparently the station in New York didn't receive my phone call after five tries. So I'm on Skype. I'm told Guy is standing by. I can hear no background music. I don't know if I'll hear the songs tonight. I hope I do. We got some great songs for you. It is Sunday the 22nd. Of September 2013, Sunday night. It's raining cats and dogs here in southern Colorado. We've had several inches over the last couple days. It is 25 degrees colder than normal. The wind is blowing. And, of course, as we've been paying attention, or if you've been paying around the world, we've had some we have major weather events happening all over the place tonight. Typhoon Usagi, now a tropical storm 600 miles across, is making its way over the East China coast north of Hong Kong. No damage reports yet. Well, we have had some reports of deaths, but it's a big storm, 600 miles across, last tracked, moving at about 20 kilometers per hour. That's a slow mover that's going to dump an unprecedented amount of rain on the region. There is a new tropical storm. You can't keep track of the names forming in the Pacific. We will be tracking that on Facebook. And so I'm here kind of talking tonight without a lot of my normal luxuries, but I still think this is going to be an outstanding show. It's great to have Guy McPherson back with us. There's something I want to bring up which kind of set a theme for the week that I wanted to carry into the show. And it's not an all wonderful theme, because there's a very bittersweet quality to all of this. The Asahi Shimbun, which is one of the largest press agencies in Japan, equated with ABC, NBC, Washington Post, New York Times, published an exceptionally strong editorial this week, unheard of really for Japanese culture. But it said Abe, that's the Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, should confront the reality of Fukushima radiation leaks, dated September 21, just yesterday. And I got to read part of this to you, because it's going to set the theme for what we're going to talk about tonight. In the wee hours of September 20, a strong earthquake measuring 5+ on the Japanese seismic scale struck Fukushima Prefecture. Its epicenter was in the Hamadori area in the eastern part of the prefecture, where the wrecked Fukushima No. 1 nuclear power plant is located. Actually, it's 1, 2, 3, and 4 that are wrecked. Even though it caused no damage to some 1,000 storage tanks within the plant that are filled with radioactive water, the quake must give many people a chill. On the previous day, Prime Minister Shinzo Abe visited the crippled plant and reiterated his view about the effects of contaminated water, saying they had been completely blocked within a certain range. That was in quote. But he is over-optimistic. This is one of the largest press agencies in Japan, but he is over-optimistic if he really believes what he said about the problem. We all knew that. He needs to appreciate the seriousness of the situation and make an all-out effort to prevent unforeseen disasters like massive leaks of contaminated water. Symbolical of Abe's warranted optimism about what is going on at the plant is his claim that the situation is, quote, under control. He made the remark earlier this month in his presentation at a session of the IOC, which helped Tokyo to be chosen as the host city for the 2020 Olympic Games. After his statement was reported around the world, however, a senior executive of TEPCO, the operator of the Fukushima plant, rebutted his argument, saying the situation was not under control. during the IEA's International Annual General Conference meeting held on September 16 through 20 in Vienna. Representatives of many countries raised questions about Abe's statement. China, for instance, voiced strong concerns about how things stand at the Fukushima complex. Mindful of the international perceptions, Ichida Yamamoto, Minister of Science and Technology Policy, didn't use the phrase under control in his official speech at the IEA meeting. We are not demanding that the Prime Minister, we are not demanding, this is Asahi Shinbun, that the Prime Minister describe the situation with complete accuracy. We are now demanding, I believe, that it says not. We are concerned that he may be confusing the goal with reality. Efforts are certainly underway to put the radiation crisis under control and completely block the effects of polluted water, but that doesn't mean the situation is actually under control or that the effects are completely blocked. At the moment, how much radioactive water is flowing into the sea and what underground route it is taking to reach the sea can only be guessed. That remains the situation. That means the situation is far from being under control. The Prime Minister's words carry great weight if he voices an over-optimistic view about the current situation concerning levels of contaminated water. The efforts to deal with the problem could be prematurely relaxed. That's a big issue right now. One big mistake concerning the problem was made by the previous administration, now that's of NOTA. In December 2011, the NOTA administration declared that the Fukushima nuclear crisis had been resolved. But in fact, only a stopgap system to pour water onto melted reactor cores had been established. As a result, the problem of polluted water accumulating at the plant dropped from the list of important topics of political debate and lost the attention of the general public. That's the real danger right now on many fronts. News media should also do soul searching over their failure to communicate the seriousness of the problem sufficiently to the public. At the IAEA meeting, one inevitable question was raised. The problem of radioactive water accumulating at the Fukushima plant has been recognized from the beginning. Why is it that no serious effort has been made to find a solution for as long as 2 years? British science magazine Nature takes a dim view of the Japanese government, which has announced a plan to take over the cleanup, that they will be able to cope with the crisis. Quote, given the government's past actions and information policies, one might doubt whether it would be any more competent than TEPCO at managing the situation and communicating it to the public, it commented in a recent issue. The current situation of the crisis warrants no optimism. The Abe administration needs to honestly acknowledge the enormity of the challenge and communicate its view and related information to audiences both at home and abroad. Then it should start taking steps to gain necessary knowledge and support from all over the world to tackle the challenge effectively. Asahi Shinbun. Now, that's accompanied. Lying flank around that, there's a number of Japanese cities where their councils are standing up to the Abe administration saying bullshit in the polite Japanese way, where they are questioning the government's policies, where international press organizations are saying we don't believe it. There is an awakening occurring, which is also happening on the inner front, on the international front, with respect to Syria and the United States standing in the world this week. Evo Morales of Bolivia announced a suit against the U.S. government for their harassment and spying. President Dilma Rousseff of Brazil has refused to attend a conference with the United States because of NSA wiretapping. And there are real serious signs that people are standing up instead of rolling over and playing dead. That's the good news. The bad news we are going to talk about with our guest tonight. I'm going to bring him on right now. Guy McPherson's been with us three times before. Everybody here knows who he is. We love him. He has become, whether he wants to or not, an iconic figure in what we would call this beautiful flame coming out of human spirit at what may be our last minutes of existence on the planet. You will know him as a professor emeritus of natural resources and ecology and evolutionary biology from the University of Arizona, who gave that career up because he was absolutely aware. He had integrity. He had honor, like so many people we've had on this show, like the Helen Caldicotts, like so many people who we respect and admire here, to walk away from Empire and all of the great perks of being a professor emeritus. He's now living the permaculture life, and he's the star of a recent film, which is a great film, Somewhere in New Mexico Before the End of Time. He has his memoir is Walking Away from Empire. Great book, great, great quote. His website, Nature Bats Last, is found at GuyMcPherson.com. And Guy, I have to tell you tonight, it's really good to have you here because the weight this week feels really heavy. And if you and I are oxen, I would be happy to walk beside you and carry the load for a little bit. And I'm glad to have you here. Welcome back.
Well, thanks very much for having me, Mike. It's always a pleasure to be on your show.
Okay, so you heard what I opened with after we resolved the tech difficulties, and you know, there are some really positive things out there, but the question, the bittersweet question, is it enough, is it in time, and can we keep up the momentum? That point was raised in the Asahi Shimbun piece, where, okay, we've kind of won on, for the time being, on Syria. There's some stories breaking on that, that the Dracula U.S. is stepping up again, but it is good to see that there is some degree of mobilization. But during the course of the week, and I'll start with this and ask if you agree, I've come to a very clear conclusion, and this came as a result of some dialogue on permaculture that took place on my Facebook page. Permaculture was that I'm privileged to have been in a film with one of the co-founders of permaculture, David Holmgren, and knew some very great permaculture people in Northern Cal. And they describe it as thoughtful and protracted observation. But observation implies that you observe with the understanding that you will have some predictability as a result of that observation. Absent anything being predictable or stable for your observation, it's kind of a fool's errand. And there are two issues now, being Fukushima and really accelerating climate collapse, which prevent any kind of stability at all. And those seem to be like, if those issues are not addressed, nothing else matters. Agree, disagree, what do you think?
Absolutely agree. We're in the midst of climate chaos. We have triggered 25 self-reinforcing feedback loops. 23 of those are irreversible at temporal spans relevant to our existence on the planet. So we're in the new normal, and it's not like it's been for the last several thousand years. We're beyond the point of climatic stability. That doesn't mean that we should just do nothing, just throw up our hands and abandon perfectly reasonable activities like permaculture and resistance. Mm-hmm. But it does indicate, at least to me, that we're all in hospice now, that the Earth is in hospice. Mm-hmm. We should act with the kind of compassion towards other human beings and non-human organisms that we are capable of acting.
How do we measure a new normal now? How long will this normal be normal before there's another new normal? I mean, the rate of change seems to be accelerating.
It absolutely is. We are seeing geologic events play out in real time. We've had 342 months with above average global temperatures. The odds of that happening in the absence of global scale warming exceed the odds of plucking a single atom from the entire universe.
Would you say that again, please?
We've had 342 months of above-average temperatures at the global level. The odds of that happening in the absence of global warming exceed the odds against plucking a single atom from the entire universe.
I think it's reasonable to say that at this point, because I just got tired of a lot of really nonsensical dialogues, and we can address a point quickly that some people were quick to post this week, that there suddenly is more Arctic sea ice than before. That's been addressed, but I mean, I'm sitting here about an hour and a half south of Boulder, Colorado, which is just had 18 inches of rain, 1970 some oil and gas wells overwhelmed, leaking into the environment. We're witnessing Typhoon Usagi devastate eastern China at the moment. That's what the biggest storm of the year. Typhoon Manji. I mean, the abnormal weather events are all around, all over us. How does one not? I mean, how do you protect? Those aren't there, and try to analyze angels on the head of a pin.
Well, Upton Sinclair had a great line about that very thing. You're going to have a hard time getting a man to understand something when his salary depends upon him not understanding it.
Uh-huh.
There's a lot of people out there whose salary depends upon them not understanding that the world is changing at an astonishing rate.
You had said, you were on the show back in August, and I think at that time it was 19 or 21 feedback loops, self-reinforcing feedback loops that were available then. Now it's up to 25. So that brings up two questions. Number one is, how do we know what a new feedback loop is? How are they identified and verified, and what are the new ones?
Well, I'm only citing refereed journal literature and similar sources, such as the United States National Sea and Ice Data Center. So it has to be a really reputable source before I'm going to call it qualifying as a feedback loop. And what counts is, imagine you roll a ball down the hill, and there's no rocks, there's no trees in the way, it's a really smooth incline. That ball is going to pick up speed no matter what you do once the ball starts rolling down the hill. Mm-hmm. That's what a feedback loop is. The worse it gets, the more likely it is to get worse. So melting of Arctic sea ice is a classic example. As the Arctic sea ice melts, the albedo is reduced. The absorption from the sea is increased, so you get more warming of the sea and of the planet, and that accelerates the rate of melt. So albedo or reflectance goes down, and so you get increased warming, which exacerbates the problem of the sea ice melting. And I want to address that issue of sea ice very briefly, because
sure,
it's been all over my Facebook page and all over my website for the last week or so that the Daily Mail out of the UK posted an article about the sea ice increasing, Arctic sea ice increasing at a record rate. And what they're doing is they're comparing two points. They're comparing the lowest sea ice, Arctic sea ice level ever from 2012, and then comparing it to the 2013 date for the same date. And sure enough, 2013 isn't quite as bad as 2012, but 2013 Arctic sea ice is still nearly 2 standard deviations below the long-term average. It's not as if things have suddenly, miraculously become all better. There's a little blip. It's like that ball we rolled downhill ran into a rock, and so it careened off course a little bit instead of proceeding straight down. Or maybe it hit a tree and it bounced back just a little bit. But the trend is all bad. The trend is all still downhill.
So this might be likened then to a chronic gambler sitting at a gambling table who's lost 20 straight hands in a row, and he wins one, and so he decides he's going to win from now on, and then goes back and gets another loan and draws some on his credit line to play the game, right?
Exactly. That's a great analogy. Exactly.
Okay. All right. So you say there's 25 feedback loops now. What are the latest ones that have appeared?
Well, let me first point out something that that was written 2 days ago.
Okay.
John Davies, writing for the Arctic Methane Emergency Group, writes, and I quote, "The world is probably at the start of a runaway greenhouse event which will end most human life on Earth before 2040, end quote. He considers only atmospheric carbon dioxide concentration, not any of the self-reinforcing feedback loops that I'm about
to
discuss.
Dear.
So there's 25 of those feedback loops. He's just looking at carbon dioxide and concluding that it's game over for essentially all humans by 2040. Okay, so if we add in those feedback loops, of course, it's obviously a lot worse. One of the more recent feedback loops was reported by Truthout. We don't need any scientific journal for this one. Supertankers are taking advantage of the slushy Arctic, thereby demonstrating that every catastrophe represents a business opportunity. So there's a professor in journalism, Michael Nyman, who pointed this out first. The supertankers are going through the Northwest Passage now, the long-sought Northwest Passage, finally open, so we can conduct trade. What that means, we can save a few bucks in shipping by going through this slushy Arctic. So that's one feedback loop that we could reverse if we had the will, if we had the willingness to turn that around. The ones that appear to be irreversible to me, the four latest ones I know about, let's say five latest ones, all since August of this year.
Wow.
Arctic ice is growing darker and therefore less reflective, and that's because as ice melts, it exposes more dirt, soot, pollution, rocks, and so forth, so it's becoming less reflective. That was reported in Nature Climate Change in August 2013. Extreme weather events are driving climate change. That was reported in the 15 August 2013 issue of Nature. And so the events like you're seeing now near Boulder are actually accelerating climate change. And as climate change accelerates, those extreme events become more common. What happens is they release a bunch of carbon into the atmosphere. They're killing a bunch of trees.
Sure.
They're accelerating decomposition and slowing photosynthesis. Number three, ocean acidification is leading to release of less dimethyl sulfide, or DMS, by plankton. DMS shields the Earth from radiation, so it acts as an umbrella. Ocean acidification is leading to the release of less of that by plankton. So the plankton are dying because the ocean is becoming more acidified. As a consequence, there's release of less of this umbrella DMS than there was before. Sea level rise is causing slope collapse, tsunamis, and release of methane, as reported in the September 2013 issue of Geology. And finally, rising ocean temperatures are upsetting the natural cycles of carbon dioxide, nitrogen, and phosphorus, thereby further reducing plankton. This is reported in Nature Climate Change in September 2013. Those latter two are from this month. The previous ones are from a month ago, and that's five irreversible ones within the last month and a half, and one reversible one.
Now, you have been fulfilling for many of us like two roles, one of which is to just do your stellar work on climate science to bring us the information in an utterly professional way. You're the Arne Gunderson of climate collapse, and Arne Gunderson is the Guy McPherson of nuclear disasters. And you've been doing that in a way that has endeared you to all of us. But you've also, and I salute you for this, delved into the human, emotional, spiritual aspects of this. And one of your trademark lines is resistance is fertile. And you and I both have been exhorting, if you will, but behaving like a company first sergeant to people to tell them, number one, defeatism is the worst thing that we can face right now, and I'm surprised at how much I'm seeing. And I want to set up, we're coming on up to the bottom of the hour, and I had three songs picked, and we may only play two. I'm going to roll without a commercial break tonight. But Australia has a new prime minister. His name is Abbott. He is a neocon out of the worst cloth, and less than 24 hours after taking office in Australia, he ordered the dredges to start digging up the Great Barrier Reef in Australia because he plans to build the world's largest coal port terminal. And you've said clearly, and it's pretty clear to all of us for a number of reasons, that the only thing that's going to save our lives right now is an immediate end to industrial civilization. So I want to set up this song, Guy, and I'm going to play this song through the station break. This is Michael C. Rupert, Tracker of Truth, here on the Lifeboat Hour on PRN. Coming up on the bottom of the hour, we'll roll this through the bottom of the hour. But I watched a great segment with of Russia Today this week, and she's coming on the show, and I'm going to be on with her, and I've got a request out too to Arne Gunderson. But there was a rap song, and I do believe that the world did rise up effectively, and that Vladimir Putin was able to stand up to the U.S. in part. But the whole world stood up to the U.S. because there was a clear perception that 7 billion of us actually do make a difference when we get on the same page. And there was a great hip-hop song that Abby played on her show by Maurice Cecil that we're going to play here. And it talks about the kind of spirit that is necessary that we have to keep right now, even as dark as things look. So let's hear this song, Hands Off Syria, right now, and we'll roll that through the break, and I'll be back with Guy McPherson right after the song.
Yeah. Yeah, you better get your hands off of Syria. Don't believe all the media hysteria. They say the whole country is against the side. What about every single pro-government march? What about the character of the opposition? What kind of government do they really envision? It's like Libya 2.0 if you ask me. The CIA is now just sitting and laughing. They take popular discontent and spin it. Wanna see the Arab revolution diminished. What about Palestine's support from Damascus? Let's still remain if the country is captured. Clear that the Zionists support the rebels. Wanna see the Baptist state just leveled. What really benefits is the question to ask. We should know much better from the most recent past. The balance of forces in the world today. We know the biggest enemy is the USA. We know they scheme and manipulate you stepping away. But they not messing with Syria today. They better get their hands off of Syria. They better get their hands off of Syria. They better get their hands off of Syria. In historical context, otherwise all we talking is nonsense. First of all, what's democracy? Does it take precedence over sovereignty? Been problems in Syria for quite a long time. Yes, they are very real, and yes, you'll find some very real genuine discontent, but it's not the overwhelming environment. And these very real shortcomings of the state don't make it like Egypt, a client state. Wanna knock Syria en route to Iran and sever the anti-imperial bond. People dying war, an unfortunate fact. It's not a one-sided string of attacks. Rebels killing Christians, Alawis and NATO's on the ground, there's no need to pretend. The balance of forces in the world today. We know the biggest enemy is the USA. We know they scheme and manipulate you stepping away. But they not messing with Syria today. They better get their hands off of Syria. They better get their hands off of Syria. They better get their hands off of Syria.
Now that's a sign. I'm getting feedback again. That's okay. It's cool now. That's a sign that that there is something stirring in human consciousness. Our guest tonight on the Lifeboat Hour is Guy McPherson, and I, for one, am all for encouraging this and what we're seeing in Japan in any way possible, because the only alternative is to roll over and wait to die, which is not good. So I'm going to go on to the personal side here with Guy McPherson. First, let me just toss this out. There was a great little clip. I don't know if you saw it. It was an article on Desdemona Despair, which is a good site this week, Guy. Virginia mayors were having a conference, and they stood up and started screaming, "Time to respond to climate change. There are more 100-year storms in the last 15 years than they've seen in 300 years. That should be a clue, shouldn't it? Guy, are you there?
Yes, I saw that article as well, and it's pretty telling.
There's a time when we really stop arguing with fools here, and that's a moment of inertia it's a critical mass that I've been trying to see. So now we talk about resistance in the face of these pressing realities. First, I want to ask. I know you are a carrier of depression, but for many of us, you're a carrier of inspiration, because you do say, you know, we have to fight back and stand up. Where are you with that? What are you seeing as you put your finger or nose to the wind?
Well, like you, I see a lot of people throwing in the towel, claiming that we've reached a stage at which nothing will work, so let's not do anything. Let's just party like it's 1999. And And my response to that is, obviously, resistance is fertile. It's a moral imperative, and we should resist, even if, I would argue, especially if it's hopeless. Anybody can join the side that appears to be winning and feel good about themselves.
Mm-hmm.
How about the side that it looks absolutely, completely hopeless? How about playing for the all-girls Mary Williams School for the Blind against the Dallas Cowboys? Let's root for the team that's getting absolutely pummeled here. And let's not just root for them. Let's do something for them. Let's join the team. You know, this notion that we're entitled to electricity, that we're entitled to the world's reserve currency, that we can and should act like hedonists because that's the only thing left to do, those kinds of responses irritate me a little bit, we'll say.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know what to do for individuals. I know what I'm doing, and I'm a fan of organizations that promote doing something. And here I'm thinking Idle No More and Blazing Cat Productions and Deep Green Resistance and the Occupy Movement, and the list goes on and on. And there are people standing up and fighting back instead of just capitulating to the corporate government,
mm-hmm.
or the corporate governments of the world. So if you're damned if you do and damned if you don't, let's do. Let's do something.
I mean, truly, and I've seen this, and I think all of us, to be honest, and this has happened with me personally, and I will share this, is that there have been times when I have looked at this stuff many times over the last 35 years, but especially over the last decade, as I have watched so many of the things that I foresaw taking place, and you know, there are things that I didn't foresee about how fast climate collapse would take place, and nobody could have foreseen Fukushima. But there have been times when I have gone through those places where, God, I just want to lay down. I just want to, you know, I just want to go to sleep and not wake up. But I have not been able to stay in that place. I have not been able to furnish that rut. It's too devastating. And if there is any time to fight, it's got to be right now. Now, let's say we were fighting, Guy. There's a question which I would pose to Arne Gunderson, and I put out a request to have him on the show. I think he'll come on. And I said, okay, take money and governments and borders completely out of the picture. Assume there is just 7 billion human beings who are all... of the same consciousness. Hopefully we'll achieve that. There is just the resources, the physical resources available on planet Earth and the crisis at Fukushima. What would you do? No other obstacles. Get out of the box. What would we do now in terms of climate change, assuming that all obstacles to addressing any changes on climate change were removed?
Well, I think, number one, we have to decommission every nuclear power plant in the world as quickly as possible. We have to mm-hmm. throw everything we have at that. Simultaneously, we have to, for all practical purposes, terminate industrial civilization. And so we have to simultaneously maintain enough industrial civilization to decommission every nuclear power plant in the world, while also shutting down all other industrial activity. On top of that, we need to throw every known strategy at sequestering carbon from the atmosphere. That's a lot. That's not a World War II effort. That's a World War Z effort to the 100th power. This is bigger than anything we've ever faced as a species before.
It's life and death. It's do or die, and it's do or die right now, right?
Absolutely, at the level of our species. Not just for individuals, but for every single one of us, as well as for our entire future.
Now, I have said, you know, throughout the course of my career, one of my trademark lines is, until you change the way money works, you change nothing, which is essentially the heart of industrial civilization. But within industrial civilization, there are, and assume we take out infinite growth, there are parts that emit carbon, which is the chief objective. In other words, we need to stop emissions. That's the first priority within shutting down.
Sure, absolutely. And nuclear power plants come into play here as well. Most people think nuclear power plants are carbon neutral. But in fact, building those cooling towers, which requires a tremendous amount of concrete, creating concrete, extracting the limestone for the cement, means that there's a tremendous amount of carbon that is emitted in the process of building this cooling tower. So the nuclear power plants typically don't become carbon neutral until they've been in operation for at least two decades. So one way, the easy money, the low-hanging fruit for dealing with the carbon problem is to not emit it in the first place. So let's stop building those nuclear power plants and then let's start decommissioning them, because they're a huge part of the problem. Most people think they're not part of the problem. And they're not just a part of the problem. They are a central part of the problem in that they feed into our addiction to electricity.
Yes.
You know, there's a lot of places in this country that didn't have grid-tied electricity until the 1960s. The rural South didn't have grid-tied electricity until well after World War II. And guess what? People got along just fine.
Mm-hmm.
We don't need electricity to have decent lives. We need clean water and healthy food and some ability to maintain body temperature, and we need a decent and loving human community. And that, as nearly as I can tell, is what we've gotten along fine with for the first 2 million years of the human experience.
Electricity is, without doubt, and here I tip my hat to Richard Duncan, one of the early pioneers of the peak oil movement from the University of Oregon, who said, electricity is the lifeblood of the human industrial economy. It cannot operate without, especially now that we have cell phones and all that. But we could do that. But if all 7 billion of us got on the same page, we wouldn't all stop driving our cars tomorrow. We would shut down coal-fired plants, right? We would go after the biggest emitters. Who are the biggest emitters, Guy?
Well, the transportation sector is huge, and the biggest emitter, of course, if you're looking within boundaries, is the United States. 4.5% of the world's human population and a quarter of the world's carbon emissions, a quarter of the world's trash, garbage, a quarter of the world's pollution, a quarter of the world's incarcerated individuals, and on it goes. So if you want to shut down the biggest emitter, that means shutting down coal-fired power plants in the United States and also the transportation sector. Because the transportation sector, no matter how it operates, relies on carbon emissions, whether it's oil or coal-fired power plants for those nifty metro lines that rely on electricity.
Mm-hmm. And they come back and boast that they're carbon-free, which is, of course, nonsense. Telling the truth seems to be one of the biggest problems the human race has a problem with. I have a listener, Andrew Sander, who posted a question on Facebook. And I'm going to open the lines in a minute for a few calls. I'm going to chop one of the songs out tonight. Guy, you picked a perfect song that I'm going to close the show with tonight. We'll set that up and leave that with them. But Andrew Sander wrote on Facebook, I'm skeptical of the need for any interaction with the powers that were, which is what I call them, aside from self-defense against them. But there are those of us who are closer to levers of power who may still have some important opportunities. For example, I can't think of any way that I personally can do anything about preventing Fukushima No. 4's fuel rods from being exposed and catching on fire permanently with disaster and worldwide consequences. But I suspect there are people who are, one, not insane, and two, could push for something useful to be done. Now, this also, and I'll segue into this, there's a statement from IPCC that they're going to issue a quote-unquote tough statement on climate change soon. You may want to laugh at that. I'm sure you've probably seen that. But if we are truly, and we are, and I totally agree, this is the last, this is World War Z. This is, yes, this is it. And there are no other opportunities to make mistakes. Is there anything that comes to your mind? I mean, in my mind, I just sit back and I say, I don't see how anything's going to change until 7 billion of us or the 100th monkey arrives and we all understand that we have to do something. Do you have any strategic thinking about that? And what do you think about the ICC? We're going to get tough statement.
Well, I can't imagine they're going to get tough. That's a political document to a great extent. It's barely, marginally a scientific document. I think it's so well vetted by politicians and political bodies that the watered-down result produced by the consensus process in science is further watered down so that it becomes essentially meaningless.
Okay.
What to do? If this requires a change in consciousness for 7.1 billion people, well, I don't see that coming.
So
I'm with Ander in that I think it's imperative that people who are pulling the levers of industry start acting like the future matters. What can be done at that level? Well, it almost certainly is too late to turn around near-term human extinction. But, as I said before, acting like that ensures that it's self-fulfilling prophecy and we must resist, especially if it's hopeless. So what can those people do other than building themselves hideouts in the southern hemisphere for them and their family? They could do things like show a little leadership on the Middle East, show a little leadership on our food production and distribution system. It was leadership that produced the Victory Gardens in World War II, and we seem to be running away from that and into the arms of GMO companies instead. Food waste accounts for a tremendous carbon footprint. And again, particularly in the United States, where we throw away over a third of the food that is purchased. There's dozens of things that people who have influence can, and in my opinion, should be doing in terms of carbon emissions and, as importantly, carbon sequestration. None of them seem to be pointing in the right direction at this point.
If any of the listeners would like to ask Guy a question, the number is 1-888-874-4888, 1-888-874-4888. We're in the last 15 minutes, and 7 minutes of that is going to be a very special piece of music. Guy, I think, has heard the version that we're going to play of the song that he asked for, but I'll just give you a hint that if I was going to leave the audience with any message tonight, I think it would be the message that's in this song, which we're not going to do yet, but I wanted to set that up because I think it's a very powerful thing. I think, Guy, one of the reasons that people so respect you is because you are willing, as I have been, and as you're a leader, and there are many leaders around. You know, Helen's a leader, Carolyn Baker's a leader. There's a lot of people out here kind of showing the way through this dark place that we're walking as we approach this time. You have shared your heart. You have shared your emotions. You have shared your feelings. Just tell me from a gut level, how are you feeling right now?
I was visiting with a counselor recently, and I told them my line that I frequently use when I'm speaking, that I'm not depressed, that I'm a carrier. He asked me a few questions, and he concluded that I'm no longer just a carrier, that I'm actually depressed as the people I'm speaking to. I don't think I've been there before, not for any significant period of time, and I didn't even recognize it in myself. But I think that's probably right, that I'm in one of the worst places, perhaps the worst place I've been in my life, in memory anyway.
Because thank you for sharing that. Yes, yes. Good. Please go on. I'm sorry.
Because what we're doing, because of my absolute inability to turn anything around. And for a teacher, and especially for an academic teacher with the world's largest ego, academics are professional narcissists, after all. I mean, it's difficult for me to absorb the fact that I've been teaching for a really long time, and as nearly as I can tell, I've had no impact. The runaway train has speeded up, has been going faster and faster as I've been trying to teach. And so that's tough. That's tough for me to deal with, even acknowledging the lack of hubris associated with making that kind of statement.
I have to share and totally agree with you, and thank you so much for sharing that, that I have been extremely depressed over the last 2 weeks or so, because the news, it just seems, it is so tsunami-like, and there are, you know, the it is so apparent. I think you wrote recently this is the day, or the day is now, and this is it. You know, we are facing this right now. And it's sometimes exceptionally hard to walk with. But I do take enormous, I smile when I see people standing up over Fukushima. And in Japan, to stand up to the government is like a much bigger thing than it is for us here in the States or in the Western world. When I see people standing up over Syria, when I see people standing up over civil liberties, part of me says it may be too little too late, but I'm glad I could see it. Now, the only thing that's been that has really gotten me through this week is I've participated in a number of Native American spiritual ceremonies, and those have lifted me up a little bit. And I guess one of the things that this is just my perspective, guy, and it's personal from me to you and every, you know, all the tens of thousands of people who are listening is that I want you to know that I love you and I am grateful that you are here. And there are so many of us on this planet right now who are shining so brightly, for whom I am grateful. And I'm glad I got a chance to say that. We have a caller. Eric from Pennsylvania. Are you there?
Yes, I am. How's it going, Mike?
All right. Go ahead and ask your question for Guy.
All right, Guy. Yeah, I mean, I wanted just to chime in and make sure that we don't forget that there's tons of technology that the government has stolen, confiscated, and buried in vaults that they only have access to, and they don't allow the public to know. So whatever that they expose, whatever that we hear on the propaganda TV and the government schools and all that, this is all tier two science. Tier one science, they only have access to, and obviously they don't want to release it, but if they wanted to, there's plenty of technology that could be used to reverse and heal the planet and do a lot of good for humanity.
Guy, you first. Go ahead.
So I'm not sure I heard a question there, but I think a comment from a philosopher from about 2,500 years ago comes to mind. First, do no harm. Technology keeps making things worse. We keep applying technology. And the latest trick, of course, being proposed by a lot of different people is geoengineering to slow or stop or even reverse climate change. First, let's stop screwing it up so badly. Then let's think about turning directions. But let's stop before we turn around. That would be my suggestion. I'm not sure we can do much about the corporate government or the corporations that are burying technology anyway, other than storm the gates with pitchforks.
Yeah, that's kind of like the people who would argue that somebody used HAARP to create the rains over Boulder. And I'm going, what is wrong with you people? You're all crazy. They wiped out 1,900 of their own oil wells. You know, this is, and I do not believe that those technologies, the technologies exist to correct this mess, number one. And number two, that even if they were released tomorrow, we don't have a list of what they are or where to apply them. And there's no time or infrastructure left to put those kinds of solutions to work. The deal is, if somebody's, you know, bleeding, first you stop the bleeding. You don't apply technology so that they can bleed faster and better. Adolf Hitler was saying it in probably February and March of 1945 that he had a secret weapon, and there were still people that were going to believe that and take the ride to the bitter end. I don't think that's the answer. And I think that's as delusional thinking as quite a lot of other stuff that's coming out. We're coming down in the last few minutes, and I want to play this whole song because I know this song is important to Guy. I wish we had more time. Guy, you picked a song tonight, and I think this is a song that really hits us with the reality of the situation tonight. It's a song by Jackson Browne, and I found a great 7-minute live version done about 10-15 years ago with my good friend David Lindley playing fiddle on it. But Guy, tell us about the song you picked and why.
Well, it's Jackson Browne's "People the Deluge" from 1974. It's astonishing to me how prescient artists are. Mm-hmm. And I run into a lot of artists when I go on speaking tours, and they're the ones who haven't figured out. And Jackson Browne had it figured out in 1974, and this song is a perfect example of that.
We're going to close the show with that tonight. I'm sorry for the tech difficulties, Guy. Thank you so much for coming. Thank you for standing up, for being here like I do, like so many of us do. And I will say this to you, and I think it's true for all of us who stand up and speak up. We are performing an extremely valuable service because we tell people and we show when we walk with our walk that we haven't given up yet, and that we're still carrying a message and that we will carry that message until after the deluge. And so we're going to close the song tonight early. Guy, thank you so very much with Jackson Browne's Before the Deluge. And I'll see all you guys next week. I should have some good guests to announce during the week on Facebook. I love you guys. Try and stay dry, and let's hope for a miracle.
Some of them it was only the moment. so simple and so human. Believe that they were meant to live after the dead you. Now let the music keep our spirits high. Let the buildings keep our children. Let creation breathe in its secrets, by and by, by and by. And the light that starts within us reaches the sky.
Reaches.